this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
When the first Muslim ban was passed or signed into law in 2017, many people said it was malice tempered by incompetence because it was so poorly constructed that it fell apart immediately at protests in the courts. This felt like that.
Zahra Bilou of the Council on American-Islamic Relations recounts the successful campaign to release British journalist Sami Hamdi from ICE detention.
We have finally won against a giant that was willing to wait us out and starve us out and throw more resources at destroying this union than they were ever willing to throw at improving the conditions for their workers.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette workers have ended one of the longest media strikes in recent history after a key court ruling vindicated their fight.
I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not.
Mother Viola Fletcher, the oldest survivor of the 1921 Tulsa massacre, transitioned at 111 years old on November 24, 2025. We hear Mother Fletcher, who witnessed the violence firsthand as a young child, calling for justice, recognition, and reparations during a House Judiciary Committee hearing on May 19, 2021. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Zahra Bilou is the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. CAIR offers Know Your Rights sessions to mosques and community members while also providing legal representation to those facing civil rights violations, including FBI interviews, employment discrimination, airport harassment, school bullying, and hate crimes. Speaking to Code Pink's Marcy Winograd, Bilou recounts the successful CAIR campaign to release British journalist Sami Hamdi from ICE detention and offers advice on how people can protect their neighborhoods and schools from ICE abductions.
Tell us about Sami, about your advocacy on his behalf. He's a British journalist. What was he doing here? He was arrested by ICE. Walk us through what happened and how he's doing now.
Oh, yeah. So Sami Hamdi is a political analyst, a journalist. He's a British citizen, and he was visiting the United States with a valid visitor visa. He had already been in the United States for several days. He had permission to stay for several more months, and he was traveling. After speaking at CARE's gala in Sacramento, it was our annual fundraising dinner for our civil rights work in Sacramento, and he was traveling to our gala in Tampa, again, fundraising event to raise money for civil rights and immigration work. And he was approached by ICE agents in the domestic terminal at San Francisco International Airport. So he had checked his bag, he had gone through TSA security checks and all of that. And then he was approached by agents who asked him if he was Sami Hamdi, and then essentially told him, your visa has been revoked, you need to come with us. Now, this was on Sunday, October 26th. They handed him a memo that indicated the visa had been revoked 2 days prior. He didn't know. He had no idea. No one told him. And so he offers in that moment, well, like, okay, fine, I'll just book a ticket on British Airways and go home. And they said, no, it doesn't work that way. You have to come with us. So they took him from the airport to ICE in San Francisco. And within just a couple of hours, they already had him in a van on his way to Golden State Annex, which is an ICE detention center run by a for-profit corporation, GEO Group, in McFarland, California, 5 hours away. For all intents and purposes, they abducted him. We had no idea where he went. He was able to send out a couple of text messages, like an SOS, like something's wrong. And that's it, before they took his phone away. He shared recently that he was slammed against the transport vehicle when he was initially refusing to stop messaging. But can you imagine? He's like, this is out of a movie. Like, what do you mean? Like, I have to come with you and get in a van to somewhere I don't know. Like, I need to tell someone. And so we were able to locate him using the ICE detainee locator, which is the first place people should look if they think that someone they know or love has been abducted by ICE, so that they can see if they're in the ICE system. That sometimes helps you narrow down which agency it is. And we visited him the next day at the detention center. He told us what happened, and we immediately filed a complaint in federal court The first part of that complaint was to seek a temporary restraining order to ensure that ICE did not try to move him outside of California. When the first Muslim ban was passed or signed into law in 2017, many people said it was malice tempered by incompetence because it was so poorly constructed that it fell apart immediately at protests in the courts. This felt like that, malice tempered by incompetence, because if they wanted to really harm him, they would have waited until he landed in Florida and picked him up there, where the courts are less friendly and the facilities are much worse. I'd hate to go to an ICE detention center anywhere, but California would be the place to go over Florida. So the court agreed with us that the Trump administration has been moving political prisoners, and that in case they tried to do that here, they had been instructed not to. We also filed a habeas in that same filing, claiming that there was no lawful basis for Sammy's abduction and detention, and that he should be set free. Our concern was that Sammy had been targeted by right-wing online voices like Laura Loomer and Amy Meckelberg just a few days prior. And Marcy, here's what's so strange about this. Before his family can call us, and before our CEO, who he also reached out to, could call us to say, Sammy's been taken, we have to mobilize, Laura Loomer broke the news. How did a right-wing online activist get firsthand news of a British journalist being abducted by ICE on a Sunday morning on the West Coast? And so that was the point that we made to the courts, is something is not right here. He's being targeted by the government for his speech, and potentially at the request of these right-wing online voices. The government said to the court, you don't have jurisdiction over this. And the court said, in fact, we do. Now, Department of Homeland Security and government, so both the official agency Twitter account or X account and various government voices were on X smearing Sammy, accusing him of spreading ideas that were not welcome in the United States, of all sorts of things. But they didn't say any of this to the judge, right? So in the court of public opinion, where there was no evidentiary standard, they said whatever they wanted. But when they had to say it seriously on paper, they couldn't. The only charge leveled against Sammy was in immigration court. And in immigration court, they said he overstayed his visa. Well, yeah, because you manufactured a visa overstay. Earlier last week, the government offered and we agreed to voluntary departure. Sammy said from the moment he was approached by the ICE agents, okay, so I'll go home. And so we agreed, he'll go home. He conceded nothing on anything else. We continue to maintain that he was targeted for his speech and that the government may have been acting at the behest of a right-wing online extremist. But here's the thing, Marcy. Well, two things. One, the facility that held Sammy has approximately 700 other detainees at it. And it's one of many, many facilities. And those other detainees are not journalists. They're not British nationals. They don't have a legal team made up of CARE California and our partners. They don't have access to the media. And so they remain detained. And the conditions he described are not going to be surprising to you and me because we follow these things, but our fellow Americans should know that even the day that he agreed to a voluntary departure, in other words, he says, I'm going home. And the government says, yeah, we have no reason to hold you. They transported him from McFarland to Fresno in shackles. And he was required to stay overnight in shackles, in a facility that we don't know was actually equipped to house people overnight. We know he had a medical emergency one of the days that he was there, and it took more than 6 hours for an on-site medical professional. Like, they were already there, they just didn't care enough to come help him. He only got better when one of his fellow detainees gave him medication. Can you imagine? Like, that's how we're holding thousands of people. And so Sammy has reminded us that he is not the story, but he is a window into what is happening. And of course, we know that the thing that he was saying that was unwelcome was his advocacy for Gaza. He was advocating against the genocide in Gaza. He was saying repeatedly that America should put America first by keeping those funds that we are sending to Israel here, to house people, to feed people, to provide health care for people. And that message was resonating. And that's why this government didn't want anyone to hear it.
That's a devastating story. It's a horror story. And we know that there are many horror stories. We see them on Instagram Live, people being abducted by ICE, by Border Patrol. And Trump is ramping that up even more now with Charlotte, sending federal troops into Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, you mentioned the detention centers in California being better than Florida. I can't imagine what they're like in Florida, because detention center in McFarland that you referenced, that's not that far from California City, where CoreCivic runs a 2,500-bed facility, and the detainees are now in a federal lawsuit against the government, over insects on the walls, sewage in the shower. It's just disgusting. Yeah. So with regards to Sami and other Palestinian rights activists who have been targeted, is the government asking them specific questions? Is there an interrogation?
It doesn't appear that the goal, in many of these cases, I can't speak to all of them, it doesn't appear that the goal is information gathering. It appears that the goal is suppression and intimidation. Lock Sami up so he doesn't say anything else. Lock Leika Cordia up in Texas so she doesn't say anything else. Lock Yaqub Ira up in Texas, ship him off to Louisiana so he doesn't say anything else. The same for Marwan Maruf and, of course, Mahmoud Khalil and Mohsen Madawi and Ramesa Ozturk and others as well, right? But lock them up and make an example of them so they can't say anything else, and so that they will be so scared that even if they are released, they won't say anything else. That's on them. But more broadly, make an example of them. And what gets me, Marcy, is of course how many non-citizens are now afraid to speak out because they know the consequences of writing an op-ed, as Ramesa Ozturk did, right? Or of leading a protest, as Mahmoud Khalil did, or of speaking at mosques and civil rights events, as Sami Hamdi did, is you could be locked up. And what they see is that all of these people who were initially targeted were able to mobilize resources, and some of them got out, but many of them, right? For example, Leika Cordia and Yaqub Ira and Marwan Maruf remain locked up. And so many, many non-citizens are very worried. And so they are self-censoring. But the worst part of this, the part that I didn't expect, is how many US citizens are self-censoring as well. So I frequently got questions from US citizens who were asking, can I travel? Should I travel? What do I do about my phone? Can I go to a protest? Well, that happened to so-and-so. And it's like, if there is one thing left, it is the privilege that we have as US citizens. And I say that cautiously, because about 1 week, no, 1 day before Mahmoud Khalil was kidnapped, I gave a presentation on how to plan for ICE visits or activities at your house of worship. I gave it to a group of interfaith leaders in San Francisco. And I said, green card holders are still relatively safe. Mahmoud Khalil has a green card. He was abducted the next day. I gave that same presentation a week later, and I had to eat my words. To your question, I don't think that they're trying to gather information from these detainees in this instance. I think they're just trying to scare everyone into compliance.
I think you're right about that, but I don't think any of us are really safe when we have such lawlessness underway throughout the country and people like Donald Trump acting with absolute impunity. It's frightening. So what do you tell a church or a school who is concerned about ICE agents raiding their churches, their schools, arresting? We've seen them arrest teachers, grab students. Yeah. What advice would you give?
It's really important to know who in leadership is a US citizen and would be willing to assert various rights in that facility, right? So, no, you can't enter this room without a warrant, but someone has to say it, because if you don't actually look at the documents produced, right, and say this is or is not a valid warrant, they're going to come in anyways. But someone needs to say, no, I want to see your warrant, right? Someone else needs to be willing to record what is happening, right? And I want to be really cautious here, because the government has also been targeting people who it claims are obstructing their activities. But these are things that we all have a right to do and say. Ask to see a signed judicial warrant, right? You can refuse entry if they don't have it. Video record on your cell phone anything that is happening. We have a right to record public officials in the undertaking of their duties. There's no right to privacy, but somebody has to be willing to do it, and that can't be the undocumented person in the congregation or at the school. It needs to be the US citizens. In some cases, it needs to be the white pass US citizens, right? It needs to be the able-bodied US citizens. The most privileged amongst us need to put ourselves on the front lines right now. Because if we don't, they're going to come for our neighbors, our friends, and our family members. And more what we are seeing in towns like in Chicago, right? We saw this in Chicago, we saw it in Los Angeles, is that when there are ICE activities, and by the way, there's a lot of attention on these major cities, right? Including now Charlotte, where there are major operations. But even though no one's talking about LA anymore, dozens of people are getting picked up daily, right? There's still ongoing ICE activity in Chicago. There's still ICE activity in the San Francisco Bay Area, even though it was said that, you know, they weren't going to deploy fully. Well, okay, but they're still kidnapping people with less resources. We need to make sure that we're mobilizing, that we're engaging our rapid response networks, right, to verify ICE activity, that we're advising non-citizens amongst us how we can help, right? How help them with their groceries, help them with like pickup and drop off. And by the way, if they're not citizens, another thing that we should be advising them to do is to be developing safety plans, right? Who's going to take care of the kids if something happens? Where is the important information saved if something happens? And do you and your family have an immigration attorney on speed dial? And so there's a lot that can be done. And what do they say? An ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. And that's unfortunately really the thing here is, even in Sammy's case, putting aside just how privileged he was to be of British background and to have all of this global attention on him, he had our CEO's number on speed dial. And so he was able to reach Care California CEO Hossam Ailoush when all of this was happening, right? If he didn't have that, the scramble may have been longer.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Marcy. And thank you, Code Pink.
That was Zara Bilou, Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Area Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, speaking to Code Pink's Marcy Winograd.
مدفعية ودبابات مدفعية ودبابات عدين من صلوطة بالليل يا الله بالليل
بانزارو كانونر بانزارو كانونر ريك تاس مدايان قفلن من بس قفلن
جوزه موجود على جبال جوزه موجود على جبال وبحارب مع الأحرار بالليل يا الله بالليل
مين معناري
ذهب الفدائية وبحارب في الأغوار بالليل يا الله بالليل
من منار الفدائي من منار الفدائي جبار مطيان دم قبلت من من قبلت
جوزه عامل وبن عامل يا جوزه عامل وبن عامل وبحارب الصهيونية بالليل يا الله بالليل
Palestinian Struggle Songs, Kofia. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Sudan is now the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world. According to the International Rescue Committee, it is experiencing the largest recorded and fastest displacement crisis in the world. The healthcare system has collapsed and famine has set in. The infamous Rapid Support Forces, a descendant of the Janjaweed, are in control of El-Fasher, where they have been proudly filming themselves committing atrocities. Sudan's civil war, which began in April 2023, is, for one, a fight for power and resources between two greedy generals. One is General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, head of the National Sudanese Armed Forces, and another is General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemedti. However, Ahmed Kabalo, Sudanese editor of Sovereign Media, says it is important to understand that there are powerful foreign forces acting in the background for their own nefarious motives. He recorded this ex-post after a sleepless night in Nairobi.
It's 5 a.m. here in Nairobi. And, I've not got much sleep. As many Sudanese people watching the videos coming out of El-Fasher and the crimes committed by the RSF soldiers are horrific, and they are responsible and they should be held accountable, and one day they will be held accountable. We've seen people shot on camera, women sexually abused, them screaming, the girls were over there, let's get to the girls. before they do God knows what to those women as well. It's horrific. And they're filming themselves doing this. So it's one of those situations where, you know, people see these young African men with AK-47s, and it just feeds into all the stereotypes about, you know, Africans at war and whatnot. But I need to say this. There's a lot more people responsible for what's going on in Al-Fasha. The European Union. The European Union funded, gave support to the RSF, knowing that they were a bloodthirsty, gun-for-hire mercenary group. And they gave them support, not despite this, but because of this. Under the idea that who better to police the Mediterranean, who better to stop refugees from coming to Europe than one of the most vicious warlords, one of the most vicious mercenary groups in the whole African continent. So they're also responsible for what we've seen in Al-Fasha. The UK government, which was the pen holder of the UN, which got to decide what got discussed and what not got discussed, what didn't get discussed, sorry. They pressured African governments not to condemn the UAE for their role in supporting the RSF because of diplomatic and economic ties. They're responsible for what's happening in Al-Fasha. Cyril Ramaphosa, who's been hailed around the world for standing up to Israeli genocide, and he has done that. But at the same time as he was standing up to Israeli genocide, he met up with the genocidal leader of the RSF, General Hemeti. He's responsible for what's going on in Al-Fasha. Chad, Ethiopia, General Haftar in Libya, who've all been helping the United Arab Emirates smuggle weapons into RSF-controlled territories and smuggle gold out of the Darfur region into Dubai. They're responsible for what's going on. President William Ruto, who allowed this fake parallel government to be formed here in Nairobi, where I live, who's also been involved in the gold smuggling, he's responsible for what's going on in Al-Fasha. Of course, the United Arab Emirates is responsible and is the main beneficiary of the chaos, the death, the destruction that we're seeing in Al-Fasha. But all of you influencers, all of you that go to Dubai and post videos and basically don't care about the Africans, the Kenyans, the Ethiopians that are mistreated in the UAE, don't care about how the UAE is buying up all of the arable forest land to offset their carbon credits, don't care about how the UAE has been funding genocide in my country for the last 2 years. You're responsible for what's going on in Al-Fasha. Yeah, so many people are responsible. So don't just allow them to go, oh, look at these young men. Look at these young men killing. Aren't these Africans barbaric? No. The US is involved. The US could make one phone call and stop this. Instead, it wants the rare minerals from Sudan. It wants the gold from Sudan. And it will only negotiate peace if Sudan reaches some sort of submission deal that the Congo reached with the US. All of these are responsible. All of them are responsible. So yeah, it's a terrible, terrible day for all Sudanese people. But don't let all of these other parties absolve themselves from responsibility. You're all responsible. You've all got blood on your hands.
That was Ahmed Kabalo, editor of Sovereign Media, on the powerful forces behind the catastrophic war in Sudan. That was Mohamed Wardi, Light of the Eyes. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Global working class solidarity with Palestine led to a general strike in Italy on November 28th and dock workers' strikes in many European countries. In Norway on November 27th, public workers had a general strike and rallied at the capital. Unionist Susan Lydon spoke about their action at a panel of trade unionists from around the world who build solidarity and action against the genocide.
Susan Lydon from the Norwegian Association of Researchers in Norway, actually. So there is a general, there is going to be a national strike.
The 27th. There has been a call for a two-hour strike for Palestine in the three largest cities in Norway. Under the slogan, stop the genocide, withdraw the oil fund from Israel. This concerns mostly workers from the public sector, universities, schools, and local government, but there are also shop workers and building workers involved. And there will be a demonstration in front of the parliament in Oslo at 2:30. The strike is called by local trade union organisations, but it's to follow up a historic vote at the Trade Union Congress in May this year. Despite opposition from trade union leaders and the ruling Labour Party, ground plan activists put forward a vote calling for a boycott of Israel, withdrawal of the oil fund's investments, call for a ceasefire and more. And amazingly, the motion won by 240 votes to 69. So very much a great win for activists and the trade unions and a huge boost for all of us who are working for a closer relationship between the trade unions and the Palestinian movement. At the same time, the tomorrow strikes are called by local union councils in the three largest cities and supported by workplaces here and there in addition. But we really need to take it further and make the next strike a national one. If I can just say something about the demands to stop the genocide and the oil fund out of Israel, especially the demand of getting the oil fund investments out of Israel is important here in Norway. It's been at the centre of the Palestine solidarity movement in Norway, especially since October 2023. As the world's largest fund, it's also a large investor in Israel and in the weapons industry and in industries necessary to continue the destruction in Gaza and on the West Bank. Making profit from genocide shows many in Norway the hypocrisy of Norway's so-called reputation as a nation for peace. The pressure has been on the government and especially the finance minister, Jens Stoltenberg, until recently a leader of NATO, to get the offshore oil fund investments in genocide and occupation to end. The public pressure has forced Stoltenberg to pull investments in 12 companies in August, but there's still many more needing to go. In Norway, the profits from genocides, we see that the Norway profits from genocide, but our politicians are more interested in making even more money. That standing by human rights isn't as important as making even more profits. So I think that's one of the reasons why this strike will be supported tomorrow. And I think many more people will also come in front of the parliament at 2:30 to hear the speeches and contributions from trade unionists and Palestine activists together. The strike has been fought for from the ground up, and it will further be inspired by what's happening elsewhere in Italy and other countries. This show of worker solidarity is crucial and something we need to see more of across the world. So it's been very inspiring to hear from so many different people and also from the Palestinians themselves. So free Palestine.
That was Susan Lydon of the Norwegian Researchers Union talking about the national strike of public workers for Palestine on November 27th. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. After more than 3 years on strike, members of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh, affiliated with the News Guild and Communication Workers of America, returned to work at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette after a recent U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruling. The court found that Post-Gazette management had illegally violated labor law by eliminating the 40-hour week ending the short-term disability plan and weakening workers' health care, costing them thousands of dollars. The court ordered the company to restore previous contract terms and compensate employees for the years of violations. Workers spoke out about their victory before heading back to the newsroom.
We all work together, we will win.
President of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh, it's Andrew Goldstein.
Journalism has been called the first rough draft of history, but journalists don't set out to make history themselves. Our job is to seek truth, to hold power to account. Our job is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Striking was hard. Maybe the hardest thing I've ever done. But the terrain was not entirely unfamiliar. We sought the truth that we were in the right and the Post-Gazette was in the wrong. We held power to account by standing up and saying enough. We afflicted the comfortable by fighting back on the North Shore and in so many places. And we comforted the afflicted by taking care of each other, making sure that we stayed housed and fed and looking in on each other, even when the days were bleak. We made this happen. We made it so that the courts and the law firms and the corporations could not silence our voices. We fought for ourselves, and we fought for our community. We fought for journalists everywhere, and we fought for journalists of the future. In the CWA, we say, when we fight, we win. But that fight is long, and it is hard, and many sacrifices are necessary. So to the CWA, I would edit that expression to say that it's only when we fight, we win. We fought that fight, and we walked in the footsteps of the people of Pittsburgh and all across this country who have sacrificed and bled and fought and died for their rights in the workplace. The times and the characters may change, but that story never ends. It's only picked up by the next writer. And so, to the Starbucks workers and to all future striking workers in America and across the world, I say to you, take our pen and seek truth. Take our pen and hold power to account. Take our pen to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Yeah. Take our pen and fight! Thank you to all, to the steel workers and the Starbucks workers, to the nurses, the hospitality workers, the bakers, the linemen, the utility workers, the teachers. We couldn't have done this without you all. There are no words I could properly express to describe the gratitude that we feel here today. And it is time for us to go to work.
Hallelujah! Finally, after 3 years of knowing we're right, Third Circuit Court ruled in favor of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh.
I'm in shock still that we actually did it. We won.
The Post-Gazette has nowhere to go. They have to restore our expired contract, which includes guaranteed work week, health care, short-term disability, vacation, benefits for part-timers, everything that we've been fighting for.
It's been a rough go, and I've been telling people of late that being on strike is no fun, and we want to go back to work, but need a sense of fairness and justice in the workplace.
This court decision in our favor, coming 3 weeks after we marked 3 years on strike, just makes me very grateful.
We have been fighting not just for ourselves for 3 years. We're fighting for every working person because companies cannot be allowed to just tear up union contracts and throw them away. You can't do that. And now the court has affirmed that that is indeed the law of the land, and we're going back to work.
We have finally won against a giant that was willing to wait us out and starve us out and throw more resources at destroying this union than they were ever willing to throw at improving the conditions for their workers.
It's a great day for the little guy, for workers' rights. And it just shows that with dedication and just stick-to-itiveness that we can hold the big guy responsible for what he does when he breaks the law.
We finally won, and it's worth it because it's not just for us. It's for the future of the next generation of workers who are going to work for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And it's worth it for this city that's going to have dedicated journalists who are able to afford to live here and work here.
It's not something that I could have done without understanding the history of Pittsburgh and the workers here, who are actually the people who built the fortunes of Andrew Carnegie, of Henry Clay Frick, of all of these men who get upheld as the builders of the country. The workers built this country. The workers built this city.
I think this proves that it's still worth it to stand up and to fight against all odds, even if it takes a lot of time and a lot of sacrifice.
Thank you to everyone who's supported us for this long battle. We couldn't have done it without you. Truly, your support has made sticking to this picket line, which has not been easy, worth every day, every hour, every minute of effort. If you can, we're still waiting to get back in the office. If you can, donate to us at unionprogress.com/donate. Thank you for all of your support. And thank you to my fellow striking journalists for all the work that you've done over these 3 long years. I appreciate it. And so does everyone who you've helped in the Pittsburgh community and on the picket line.
Those were the voices of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette News Guild strikers who won their strike after 3 years. They also produced an online strike newspaper called the Pittsburgh Union Progress, which has covered many labor environmental stories like the Norfolk Southern derailment in East Palestine, which is close to Pittsburgh. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Mother Viola Fletcher, the oldest survivor of the 1921 Tulsa massacre, transitioned at 111 years of age on November 24, 2025. She spoke of the trauma she endured for many years and called for justice, recognition, and reparations during a House Judiciary Subcommittee hearing on May 19, 2021. She was accompanied by her brother, Mr. Hughes Van Ellis, who was 100, and survivor, Miss Leslie Benningfield Randall, 106 years young. Collectively, these brave elders shared their horrific stories of the 2-day massacre of innocent black citizens by white vigilante mobs on May 31st to June 1st, 1921. The vigilantes attacked in the Greenwood neighborhood, a 35-square-block area of thriving businesses, schools, banks, and homes, widely known as the Black Wall Street.
My name is Viola Ford Fletcher. I'm the daughter of Lucinda Ellis and John Wesley Ford of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm the sister of Hughes Van Ellis, who is also here today. I'm a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 107th birthday. Today, I'm visiting Washington, D.C. for the first time in my life. I'm here seeking justice, and I'm asking my country to acknowledge what happened in Tulsa in 1921. On May 31st in 21, I went to bed at my family's home in Greenwood, neighbors of Tulsa, the neighborhood I felt asleep in that night was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage, and my family had a beautiful home. We had great neighbors, and I had friends to play with. I felt safe. I had everything a child could need. I had a bright future ahead of me. Greenwood should have given me the chance to truly make it in this country. Within a few hours, all of that was gone. The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and five siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seen being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not. And other survivors do not. And our descendants do not. When my family was forced to leave Tulsa, I lost my chance of an education. I never finished school past the fourth grade. I have never made much money in my country. State and city took a lot from me. Despite this, I spent time supporting the war effort in the shipyards of California. But most of my life, I was a domestic worker serving white families. I never made much money, but to this day, I can barely afford my everyday needs. All the while, the city of this Tulsa have unjustly used the names and stories of victims like me to enrich myself and its white allies through the 30s, million, two through the 30s million raised by the Tulsa Centennial Commissioner while I was continued to live in poverty. I am 107 year old and have never been seen justice. I pray that one day I will. I have been blessed with a long life and have seen the best and the worst of this country. I think about the terror, horror inflicted upon black people in this country every day. This subcontinuum committee has the power to lead us down a better path. I'm asking that my country acknowledge what has been happened to me, the traumas and the pain, the loss, and I ask the survivors and descendants to be given the chance to seek justice. Open the door. All of you know how easy it is to deny that a violent mob threatened your lives and took your property. For 70 years, the city of Tulsa and its stream of charmers told us that the massacre didn't happen, like we didn't see it with our own eyes. You have me here right now. You see Mother Randall, you see my brother, Hughes Van Ellis. We live this history, and we can't ignore it. It's our lives with us. Oh, my goodness. We lost everything that day, our homes, our churches, our newspapers, our theaters, our lives. Greenwood represented all the best of what was possible for black people in America and for all the people. No one cared about us for almost 100 years. We and our have been forgotten, washed away. This Congress must recognize us and our history. For Black America, for the white Americans, and for all Americans, that's some justice. Is that it? Thank you.
Do you want to say anything else?
Thank you very much. We appreciate very much your testimony. Mother Fletcher, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So thank you for putting us on the right course to learn and to understand and to do better.
That was Mother Viola Fletcher, the oldest survivor of the 1921 Tulsa Massacre. Mother Fletcher, along with her brother Hughes Van Ellis and survivor Lessie Benningfield Randall, called for justice, recognition, and reparations during a House Judiciary Subcommittee hearing on May 19th, 2021. That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, When I Die. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The Centers for Disease Control has quietly reversed its position on the potential risk factor that the current childhood vaccine schedule presents as a significant cause of autism spectrum disorder. Dr. Peter McCullough discussed this controversial about-face by the CDC on the Stinchfield Tonight program.
You know, after years of activism, many organizations involved in raising awareness about routine childhood vaccination and, you know, its potential adverse effects, McCullough Foundation got over the finish line, a comprehensive report. It was grant funded, took over a year to produce. And we published it and had a press release on October 27th, 2025. You covered it, Grant. And that day, we sent the report to HHS, CDC, Robert F. Kennedy, sure enough, about 3 weeks later now, point by point, the CDC has capitulated on our findings. We found 29 studies that failed to find the association between combination childhood vaccines and autism, and those 29 studies were flawed. They didn't have adequate control groups of truly unvaccinated children. They never interviewed the parents or reviewed the vaccine records or examined the children. And now the CDC says those studies were not evidence-based, and we agree. The CDC has also said they are going to embark on their own investigation and report, and I've been publicly calling for that in the last 3 weeks.
All right, so we talk about your report, and it seems to be it's the combination of vaccines, not one single vaccine together. They're overwhelmingly the combination of vaccines. Do you think, besides autism, you know, I see more and more kids with strange tics, and they walk a little funny, and all any of that connected to the vaccines?
Yes, the syndrome is really when a normal child who's potentially susceptible, and there probably are genetic and other susceptibility factors, is susceptible and they receive a big bundle of vaccines, it's the combination of these products that cause inflammation in the brain, Grant, is called encephalitis. And then the encephalitis can result in a seizure, you know, that day or night, which is terrifying for the parents. And then over the next several days, weeks, or months, a post-encephalitic picture develops, and that can be attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, autism spectrum disorder, tics, these involuntary facial motions, and then seizures or epilepsy. And so all of these are on the rise right now. And sadly, it's probably due to excessive vaccination. And the implications of this development are broad and far reaching. And many parents are now asking the question, what do they do now?
There are studies out there that shows that unvaccinated children, by and large, are healthier than vaccinated children, and in big numbers, correct, Doc?
That's true. We outlined 12 studies now showing a healthy child born today is healthier if they take no vaccines whatsoever. I think the best guidance from the World Council for Health, a physician-led, evidence-based, and consensus-driven organization that issued guidance in 2023, they said, you know what, based on everything that's coming out, it's safer to wait on vaccines, and that's what a lot of parents are doing.
What do you recommend? And, you know, we're not vaccine zealots, anti-vaccine zealots. You and I have both acknowledged we've taken vaccines. I didn't take the COVID vaccine, but and I'm not taking the flu shot anymore. But what do you say to parents that are going to, you know, have a child? Do you say wait?
The parents should have a frank discussion with their doctors, their obstetrician and pediatrician. Many parents are seeking doctors who, you know, will respect the parents' wishes regarding what is done. You know, I do think the safest approach right now is to wait at least till the children are out of these critical period of neurologic and immunologic development, certainly past age 4. That seems to be where a lot of the risk is. And some parents may do the vaccines in an incremental effect, or some may forego all the vaccines altogether since the diseases of yesteryear are no longer a threat. And we have treatments. Vaccine-preventable diseases are, of course, always treatable illnesses. And we can get through this together. Let's hope the CDC embarks on a comprehensive research into the vaccine-autism connection.
That was Dr. Peter McCullough speaking on the Stinchfield Tonight program about the controversial about-face by the CDC with its recognition that unprecedented increases in childhood autism spectrum disorder have a documented link to the administration of the current childhood vaccine schedule. Dr. Peter McCullough proposes a complete review by the CDC and rethinking of the childhood vaccine schedule so as to delay most or all vaccines until at least the age of 4 years. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, Thomas O'Rourke, Akua Holt, Marcy Winograd, and myself, Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.